Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice. Justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. These are the words from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1967, when he was 38 years old. Today is his birthday, and if he were still living, he would be 88 today. We remember him each year and celebrate his life because he was a great leader in his time who has become, through the lens of our history, an undisputed hero. There were people, good people, decent people, who in his day thought that his message was too radical. They thought he shouldn't be challenging authority. They wanted him to slow down and said that he was hurting the cause because people were not quite ready for equality and desegregation. They were afraid of the upset and the violence and the radical changes to the way things had always been. Despite all the violence, the police brutality, the houses of worship that were burned to the ground for supporting desegregation and outright murder, his outspoken dream of the beloved community of peace and justice for all people never wavered. He cast an exceptional vision, a dream of an American nation with true equality, a human family of brother and sisterhood across racial lines, which captured the collective imagination, for better and for worse. The concept of true racial equality absolutely horrified and enraged some people. It is clear by the number of people who voted to elect our next president that the notion of true equality, respect for women, for people of color, for people with disabilities, for members of the LGBT and queer community, still horrifies many people in our nation. Dr. King worked tirelessly to empower the community and to engender hope during what must have seemed like the direst of times and under the most seemingly insurmountable circumstances. More than anything, we revere Dr. King because of his tremendous courage. At a time when doing so could cost a person their life, and ultimately did, Dr. King showed us what it looked like to voice the truth, regardless of the consequences. Throughout his too short career, he remained steadfast in his commitment to nonviolent means and his faith in the ultimate goodness of humanity. He reminded people again and again that the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice, while inspiring us to lay the weight of our own hands upon the arc. This is my understanding of what King accomplished. This is the way I have come to understand the importance of his words and actions that I have garnered through reading his speeches and learning about that period in our nation's history. But I am beginning to awaken to the idea that my perspective, a white, middle-class Generation X point of view, is inescapably limited. To gain a richer understanding of any phenomenon, we need to find ways to break out of the shell of our own experience and actively seek out multiple perspectives, listening especially to people whose lives are affected very differently than our own. In an essay that was posted on a blog in 2011, African-American author Hamden Rice wrote a piece entitled, "Most of you have no idea what Martin Luther King actually did." In it, the author tells of a conversation that he had with his own father, who grew up poor in rural Virginia, the son of tobacco farmers. All four of his grandparents, whom he had known as a child, had been born slaves. The author tells of coming home from college one day, all fired up about Malcolm X, and griping to his father that Martin Luther King's efforts were toothless in comparison. When his father pushed back, Rice asked him what king ever really accomplished besides giving his I Have a Dream speech. I'm going to read the author's own words that I've excerpted from the post. My father told me with a sort of cold fury, Dr. King ended the terror of living in the South. Please let this sink in and take my word and the word of my late father on this. If you are a white person who has always lived in the U.S. and never under a brutal dictatorship, you probably don't know what my father was talking about. But this is what the great Dr. Martin Luther King accomplished. Not that he marched, not that he gave speeches. He ended the terror of living as a black person, especially in the South. I'm guessing that most of you may not understand, but living in the South and in parts of the Midwest and many ghettos of the North was living under terrorism. It wasn't that black people had to use a separate drinking fountain or couldn't sit at lunch counters or had to sit at the back of the bus. Lunch counters and buses were crucial symbolic planes of struggle that the civil rights movement decided to use to dramatize the issue. But the main suffering in the South did not come from our inability to drink from the same fountain, or ride in the front of the bus, or eat lunch at Woolworth's. It was that white people, mostly white men, occasionally went berserk and grabbed random black people, usually men, and lynched them. You all know about lynching, but you may forget or not know that white people also randomly beat black people, and the black people could not fight back for fear of even worse punishment. This constant low-level dread of atavistic violence is what kept the system running. It made life miserable, stressful, and terrifying for black people. Dr. King and the other leaders of the movement helped end this reign of terror by telling black men and women to do whatever it was they were the most terrified of doing vis-a-vis white people. He told them, go ahead down to the city hall and try to register to vote, even if they say no, even if they take your name down. Go ahead and sit at the lunch counter. Sue the local school board. All things that most black people would have said back then, without exaggeration, were stark, raving, insane, and would get you killed. But King said, if we do it all together, we'll be okay. Those civil rights leaders encouraged black people to experience the worst of the worst, collectively, that white people could dish out and discover that it wasn't that bad. They taught black people how to take a beating. From the Southern cops, from police dogs, from fire department hoses, they actually coached young people how to crouch, cover their heads with their arms, and take a beating. And they taught people how to go to jail, which terrified most decent people. And the people discovered that the worst of the worst wasn't that bad. Once people had been beaten, had dogs sicked on them, had fire hoses sprayed on them, and been thrown in jail, you know what happened? These magnificent young black people began singing freedom songs in jail. That, my friends, is what ended the terrorism in the South. The jailers knew they had lost when they beat the crap out of these young Negroes, and the jailed, beaten young people began to sing joyously, first in one town and then in another. Please let this sink in. It wasn't marches or speeches. It was taking a severe beating, surviving, and realizing that our fears were mostly illusory and that we were free. I so appreciated hearing that perspective. I didn't fully understand the felt impact of the movement on black people living in the South. But I would also argue that we cannot discount the impact of the marches and the speeches and the music, which worked in concert to give people the courage they needed to take the risks that ultimately created change. People were swept in and felt a part of something much larger than themselves. And while the civil rights movement most definitely ended a certain blatant form of terror, I think the author would probably agree that it's not really over. The terror has just taken a different form. Lynchings are less common now, but also rare are the indictments of white police officers who shoot and kill innocent black men, women, and children. Houses of worship are still burned to the ground, or shot up, or covered in racist, anti-Semitic, or Islamophobic graffiti. State-sanctioned slavery has ended, but the rates of black men and women in prison is indisputably disproportionate and has created a low or unwaged compulsory labor force. As you are probably well aware, to this day, African Americans rate lower on all of the markers of health and well-being: life expectancy, infant mortality, quality public education, access to wealth and home ownership. With the election of someone who has made racist and homophobic comments, bragged about his sexual assault of women, mimicked a reporter with disabilities in front of an audience for laughs, it is no wonder that our country has seen a subsequent surge in hate crimes. By making this man our nation's president, we are effectively institutionalizing misogyny and bigotry. We are essentially sanctioning hatred. And it's not just about mean words being shouted from a podium or tweeted out on Twitter. Between the new immigration policies that he has proposed and the track records of the people he is bringing into his cabinet, whole communities of people are now afraid for their lives. This was the first national election since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013. The act aimed at overcoming legal barriers at the state and local levels that prevented African Americans from voting was one of the direct results of the civil rights movement. And now Congress is threatening to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, which would remove access to health care from hundreds of thousands of people. Many people will suffer and die as a result. So what do we do now? How do we continue to lay our hands upon the arc of the moral universe? In 1963, Martin Luther King said, "The church must be reminded that it is not the master or the servant of the state, but rather the conscience of the state. It must be the guide and the critic of the state, and never its tool. If the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become an irrelevant social club without moral or spiritual authority." In the reading that John read earlier, Dr. King warned that every society has its protectors of status quo and its fraternities of the indifferent who are notorious for sleeping through revolutions. He could very well have been speaking to us just last week instead of 50 years ago when he said, "Today our very survival depends on our ability to stay awake, to adjust to new ideas, to remain vigilant, and to face the challenge of change." What will it take for us as a people of faith to recapture our prophetic zeal? Or at the very minimum, remain awake through this great period of social change? Here's what I think it means for us and for all Unitarian Universalists across the continent. The time is now for showing up for racial and economic justice. The time is now to speak out for the rights and protection for immigrants, for the LGBT community, and for women. The time is now to reach out to our Muslim brothers and sisters and to the refugee community. It is time to create coalitions and work together. We need to realize that our liberation is bound in each other's. And this is exactly what many people here in our social justice action group are already working on. If you're not a part, please join them. To do this work well, we will need to break out of the shell of our own ideas and experiences and listen to the ideas and experiences of people who are in marginalized groups. We will need to really hear what they have to say and believe them and learn to support them in the ways that they want to be supported. Those of us living with the privilege of the dominant culture can use our access and our voices to amplify theirs. We need to follow their leadership. Come back this afternoon at 4 o'clock and hear Chief Black Fox talk about the connection between Standing Rock and San Onofre nuclear power plant. Come with me to the Women's March on Saturday. Millions of women and people who love women will be using our bodies and our voices to affirm our shared humanity and pronounce our bold message of resistance and self-determination. I promise if you come, you will feel there the power of being a part of something larger than yourself. And there will be many, many more opportunities to become involved and to make a difference. Friends, we cannot wait until we're not afraid. We are never going to be unafraid to go against the power of the state, the power of the status quo. But just as Dr. King said, if we do it together, we will be okay. And if we feel the exhilaration of having faced our biggest fears and pushed through them, once we walk into those places where we are taking the biggest risks and we realize that we survived, fear no longer has the power over us that we once gave it. We will each be called upon to do things that scare us. This will call on us to be the biggest version of ourselves that we can possibly be, the most daring, the most risk-taking. I know that white people do not generally like being uncomfortable. We are unaccustomed to it. But in this movement, we must push through that resistance because this is not about us and our comfort. It's about something much larger and much more important. Just like during that era that prompted the civil rights movement, people's lives are once again on the line. Martin Luther King Jr. lived and led during a time when the people changed the culture and the landscape that they lived in. It is time once again for us to rise up as a people. Yes, we can. Yes, we did. And yes, we will. Amen. And may it be so.